friends. As you might remember, in tarot, the Suit of Wands is about creative fire, the initiating impulse, the divine spark. It relates to fire, solar energy, and is said to be masculine in nature, i.e. muscular and passionate, penetrating, and if out of balance, it can, of course, be violent, rash, and unsustainable. Wands are also associated with trees, flowers, plants, the staff and the club, and the phallus, obviously. But as you might recall, all this wand talk is from the perspective of the Western mystery traditions. In this episode, I'm so excited to introduce you to Dr. David Delgado Shorter, a professor of cultural studies, paranormal studies, and colonialisms at the UCLA Department of World Arts and Cultures. He's also the director of the Wiki for Indigenous Languages and is the director of the Archive of Healing at UCLA. Also, he throws great parties, loves dogs, makes herbal tinctures, and is an excellent cook. In short, David is a hot item. We're giving you a call today to chat about Indigenous and anti-colonial perspectives in relation to the subject of wands. I naturally thought of his work because of a particularly brilliant talk on the flower worlds of the Yaqui Yoemi people, the Udo Aztecan-speaking indigenous people of Mexico, which I had the honor of attending at UCLA. When I saw that talk, I was so riveted. So I knew I had to bring him on the show, and I am so thrilled to have him here. Dear listeners, you are going to love it. David, we're so excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Amanda.
So I knew I had to have you on the show after seeing your talk on the flower realms of the Yaqui people that you gave at UCLA. Can you tell us a little bit about how that project came about?
Sure. It was 1992, and I had just finished a course at Arizona State University as an undergraduate that looked at all the problems in the academic study of Native people through a case study of one community, which at the time I didn't have any relations with. I wasn't hanging out with them. Now, I was actually a frequent participant in the Native American church back then, which is a peyote church there in Arizona, which is pan-tribal. But I didn't know anyone who was actually Yaqui or Yoemi. But I just finished this class and it really resounded to me because here's people who are indigenous to Mexico, and they sort of, because of their very interesting mission history where they actually beat the Spanish four times and then they invited missionaries in and then they controlled that experience, that relationship, which is unlike a lot of different Native communities. They sort of adopted Catholicism and put it into their Aboriginal logic and Aboriginal calendar system. It was kind of a bit like growing up with my great grandma. So when I was reading this material, I was responding to it in such a way that my professors and teachers were like, wow, you really get folk Catholicism. Like you get what are problemed ways or problematic ways of representing these people. And then, as if there is coincidence, we don't know whether there is actually a thing called coincidence, right? I got a phone call from a guy who was in the Native American church saying, next weekend, would you like to give a ride to the governor of the Yoemi Pueblo to a conference in Mexico? He doesn't have a route to go there, a way to go there. And he wants to hear Rigoberto Menchú speak. And I was like, yeah, I can take off work and take this guy. And he was Yoemi. He was from the Yoemi. He was like a governor of the Yoemi Pueblo. He ended up being a guy who had written three dictionaries for the community, was the governor of his Pueblo, was one of the really amazing deer singers still teaching deer songs. And that trip was, as we kind of, you know, say, a bit metaphysical. Like things happened on that trip and we connected and we still text 35, 40 years later once a week. And we're kind of like best friends. And he, after 3 or 4 years of looking over my schoolwork and thinking about how I was, he took me down and introduced me to his ancestors, his relatives down in the traditional homelands in Mexico. And I went there for 2 or 3 years before they adopted me into the ceremonial system, and the rest is history. I've written a book about them, made a film about them, created a language revitalization website for them, and worked with them for about 23 years.
Yeah, that is just so beautiful. Okay, so we're here to speak specifically about the flower worlds of the OMA. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So when I got down there, I was very interested in getting a very, what you would call, say, a holistic view of what's going on in terms of cultural differences. Like, how is it that people can have different ways of knowing, different ways of understanding the world or phenomena? And because I was a really spooky kid, you might want to call, I showed up not like this sort of stereotypical white guy who's like, I don't understand anything that's going on. But I actually was more like, hey, I have my own relations with my ancestors. I saw dead people regularly. So it wasn't for me this weird thing, but I was definitely keyed into what is the difference here. And I started using this word nature all the time. Like, is that natural? Is that natural that would happen? And it dawned on me pretty early on, they don't have a word for natural. It doesn't work that way. They have nine interrelated realms, primarily seven, but we'll call them nine if you include Christian realms. And these realms, which we call spaces or worlds, in the UMA word is aniam, which is means worlds plural, ania singular. And I learned probably in my first months that these seven interrelated worlds can kind of happen at any point during your day or night. They're not some sort of mystical experience where you have to be on a vision trip. They're not dependent upon any sort of hallucinogens. They are the night world, the dream world, the water world, the mountain world. And what they are suggesting, or I should say making possible with their words, is that when you're in these spaces, there are particular types of relationships that are available in those spaces that are not available in other spaces. And so the types of relationships and the spaces become sort of fused, which is why me and my collaborators have wrestled the last 20 some years to make given a sense of what that word world means. Because we don't mean world in terms of like a vague space, like a dream space. These worlds have agency. They can choose to show up. They can choose not to show up. They can choose to withhold their power. They can choose to offer their power. So people might, in their nighttime, which is Tukwaniya, the night world, they might have a dream, which is like Tukwaniya, right? So the Tukwaniya is inside the Tukwaniya. So the night world holds the dream world. And inside those dream worlds, there are different relationships that are possible than in the waking world. And so because of that, we often have to say that for the community, the UMA people living in the traditional homelands where I worked, they have interrelated worlds, and one of them is the flower world. And the flower world was a key focus point on an essay I just wrote last year with my long-term collaborator, Felipe Molina, because we were asked by some archaeologists and art historians to put it into conversation with what seems to be a cross-Mesoamerican world that they see inside the codices and murals and paintings. Going back thousands of years, where the flower world seems to be something that existed in other communities as well. And what they were seeing and they wanted us to reflect on was these flower worlds seem to be perhaps the oldest aspects of Native culture. They were where warriors went when they died. They are the most sacrificial aspect of life. They are not just plant worlds, but they're the plant world in bloom. So they're sort of like where the sun brings in energy into the material world of humans. That's where the plant world and the flower world, it's like a, in some ways, heaven, but we don't, of course, have that Christian notion in pre-contact terms. It's kind of where speech becomes song, flowery language, you might want to say. It's associated particularly with drums and flutes, because flutes are like staffs or like wands. And when they make music, actually in the codices, they were actually drawn as sticks that then had flowers coming out the ends, or had flowers dripping from the end of the flutes. And they're considered to be sort of an underworld across Mesoamerica. And yeah, the art is everywhere across Mesoamerica of the flower world. But Felipe and I's perspective was not that this is some sort of ancient archaeological you might want to say pre-modern era. It is still living and active, And it is still very much alive in the UMA community, as are the other worlds.
That's so amazing. I just am so fascinated. And it's just such a beautiful way of seeing reality, of constantly moving in and out of these different worlds in relation to, I guess, what we would call nature, but being inside of it. And even that idea of, I mean, because I don't have the language to talk about being something other than nature, you know, having this kind of separate relationship, I can't even really conceive of that in a way.
Which to me is incredibly ironic, because your podcast is literally Between the Worlds. Like, it's an acknowledgement in its name that we live in a multidimensional world. And this is what's so fascinating to me, is that sometimes people will think I have two different fields of study. I have Native studies or Indigenous studies, which involves, you know, things like decolonial studies. But I also teach, you know, the science of the paranormal. So I'm often inside classes talking about multidimensionality and how we might have dimensions that exist currently right next to ours, and how I interview mediums and psychics and how they talk about these veils that separate between the worlds. And in my head, I'm thinking this is all a bunch of what gets written off as New Age talk, but in fact is actually grounded in a very old, very Indigenous perspective of being able to move through different spaces in different ways. And they're all dependent upon the relations that you maintain.
Yes. So much yes to that with the relations. So, okay. So let's go back to tarot for a second. In tarot, which is part of the Western mystery tradition, the Ace of Wands is depicted as a flowering staff or branch, right? So the relationship between trees and flowers and flowering staffs and, you know, essentially, like, I don't know if we would say flutes, but yes, staffs with like flowers tumbling off the end. It appears frequently in the imagery of the tarot. And the Ace of Wands, or the suit of wands, represents that divine spark or life force essence, and it's masculine in nature. But in Yoemite culture, the flower worlds relate, from what I'm understanding, my very limited understanding of what you have mentioned already, relates to sacrifice, which is not a word that immediately comes to mind when I think of masculinity in Western culture. So why is the flower world associated with sacrifice for the Yoemite? And how does sacrifice relate to life force energy as it comes through these flowering wands and staffs and beings?
Sure. So imagine the word sacrifice is itself a double-sided mirror, and that when you turn it on the other side, the exact same word is labor. And you think about what the spade that actually tills the soil. The spade is that what brings the immaterial into the material world through labor, through work. And we think of men doing that labor in the world, or sometimes when I am thinking about how the flower world becomes associated with femininity, well, the flower itself is made up of both, with the ways that we think of, quite frankly, the birds and the bees, right? But in this sense, the men do the deer hunting. The men are the ones who do the deer songs. The men are the ones who do the bakola dancing. And when they do this ritual, this ceremonial practice that brings the flower world into being through their songs, they actually are absolutely duplicating what used to take place in deer hunts. So we know historically deer hunts used to be for men, and they used to have to learn the language of the deer. And I mean language in terms of the meta level of language, not language in terms of English or Yoemite or Spanish, but they had to learn how to communicate like deer. And if you see a deer dance now, you're still seeing Yoemite people walk like deer and act out the deer movements with the antlers. And they start essentially by doing that, bringing the Seiania, bringing the flower world dimension into the world where we're all at. But if you go back to the prehistoric times, or the times where they were hunting, which is really about the time I started doing field work, they stopped doing that much active deer hunting. They couldn't think about women or have sex for 4 days before they went. And they were doing labor for their community. Labor, you know, think of the word labor in terms of like women's labor as well. So there is an actual division of gendered labor that makes sense inside this community that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily apply to other communities. But the men are in some ways in love, or about to have relations with the flowering world in which the deer lives, and therefore they can't think about human women, and they can't cuss, and they can't be vulgar, and they can't drink and party for 4 days, because in some ways they're making their promise that they're going to be completely singular-minded for that project at hand. And I think that what's taking place here in terms of its relationship to staffs or wands is, for me, and you know me, Amanda, you know that I do playing cards rather than White Rider. I use playing cards for readings, and I see a way in which the staff or the flute is in fact a male activity in the room, but it's really actually about the material world coming into fruition. So it's some transition from one's intent, one's promise, one's sense of grace coming into the material world. And that's where you have, like, as soon as I see something like the spades, I think, okay, now we're going to get into something that's actually in the material world, something that's coming to fruition. Almost like the gestation stage is coming to an end. And now we're actually going to see the material form from that work or that labor.
I mean, exactly. That's why the tree and the flower have this relationship to wands, at least in the Western mystery tradition, is because they're moving things between the worlds, right? Like, they're moving sunlight into the earth, they're into matter, and they're moving water up their trunk and out into respiring it into the air. And so there's this conduit-like function that the wand has, and the wand also has that same function for the magician or the witch, right? That it's bringing something from one world into the other world, and it's extending the witch's body out into space, right? So it's dispersing it out into space.
I love it. It's also very sensual because of the smell of the flowers.
Yeah.
Flowers are alluring. It's like when you're on a hike or something and you see a flower and you're just like, whoa, it catches your attention. I mean, it's almost like you're at a nightclub and you're 26 and something catches your attention. Customer, you look, you get involved with the smell, you sort of are attracted to pull over to it. Like, we're not completely different species here. You're sort of like being enticed. And indigenous cosmologies around the world have this, where people would fall in love with mountains, people would fall in love with hills, people would fall in love with flowers. There are people who are committed to the flower world who I know who are plant medicine workers, and it's like their lover. It's like they literally, you know, they're like, oh, I don't know why I'm so unlucky in love with humans, because I'm so lucky when it comes to plants or flowers.
So
I know,
beautiful.
I just want to say there's something very sensual about these relations as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And in, at least in the Western mystery tradition, wands are associated with sexuality and eroticism, you know, and passion. And obviously the flower is the sex organ of the plant, kind of
right
out for everyone to
such
enjoy and to spread.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the way that I practice, that the suit that it's related to is clubs, because for obvious reasons, like with the relation of the club and the baton, but I've heard it said both ways. But so you were saying that the deer are a really big part of the flower worlds and their relationship to the deer. And I love this idea of relationality, that not only is it about the way that the worlds relate to one another, but the way that beings within these worlds are bound up in all of these relationships, which is something that's very much missing a lot of the time from the Western mystery schools. But so in Western traditions, animals do frequently appear, and they're often, you know, symbolic of something. Like a lion might symbolize fierceness or courage, or a unicorn might symbolize purity, or a stag, a connection to the ancestors of the woods. But it seems like the Yoeme don't see the deer as a symbol. What is the relationship of the Yoeme to the deer, and how do they relate to the flower world? So you're speaking to that a little bit before, but I want to go deeper into this idea of relationship.
Okay, so that question is begging to go deep. And I'm going to go deep. I'm going to go like deep, the sort of deep, like you have to sort of be in my class for 6 weeks before we can go this deep. But I'm going to try to go in quickly so that I can get there and then get to your point, because you used a word here in your question that is very, very pregnant with meaning. It's incredible of you that you can see that what's taking place is not symbolic. And that's key, because almost all readings of indigenous art, indigenous myth, indigenous everything are all through the realms of symbolism, which is not actually what's taking place. And so let me just say that there's two sort of views of languages in the world, that there are representative languages and that there are generative languages. And English is a representative language, and we use words to signify an abstract or object reality that's separate from us. So that when I say tree, you're imagining tree, I'm imagining tree, but both of us are in our heads doing this work that tree means something that's out there in the world. A lot of indigenous languages have been theorized that they are generative, which means that you can use language in such a way to create the world rather than just represent some sort of object reality that's out there. And because of that, you see it actually play out in a lot of Native communities where you don't say things that you don't want to be true. And you also don't waste a lot of breath on just mundane conversation because words are really powerful. Now, you from the world of which we would understand this because of the powers of incantations. And there are people, you know, some of my students, even at UCLA, who work with communities that use incantation. Words have power. Words don't just make meaning on a semiotic level. They actually can create the world that we live in because they make the perception and the engagement with certain phenomena possible. So, if you have a language system that has a way of talking about thunder and rocks and animals and plants as having will and intention and ability, then in fact, your language system has made a way of being in the world possible, which means those relationships are possible. And in English, we don't see those relationships as possible because we think that they are reserved only for humans to humans. Humans have relationships with other humans. Now, of course, you can say, well, I have a relationship with my cat or dog, and we do this for domestic animals. But in the Yume context, a deer is not just some random animal showing up inside the woods. A deer is bringing with the deer, deer power. And deer are some of the most powerful healers in the natural world. Deer were rumored to know how to heal other animals who were suffering. Deer had the ability to chew different plants at the same time and mash up and make a type of medicine in their mouth, which they would then put onto themselves. So they were like a healer of the animal world. When a deer shows up, it's almost like the owl in a lot of communities. It is not messing around. It is a serious, if a deer shows up in your life, that's a really big thing. You have to sort of pay attention. When was it there? How did it act when it was there? And because I've worked with, you know, 5 or 6 Native communities, and I've spent years dealing with them, and of course, because I was raised by my great grandma, who she was, I've been paying attention to animals and when they show up for a long time. And I believe that relationships are not only possible with them, in some ways, having a meaningful life means to actually show up for those relations. But I don't mean that in some sort of like romantic, all positive sense. Anyone who has power has the ability to withhold it and to use it accordingly, right? So in the UMA context, I hung out with deer hunters for about 7 years. And they were not messing around. Deer could turn a bullet around in midair and point to have that bullet go right back to the hunter, where the hunter doesn't know how he got shot with his own gun. And it's because the deer, you're not supposed to look it straight in the eye. You have to approach it a certain way. You have to talk in circumlocution around it because you have to sort of defer respect by not using its name. So this is not a symbolic relationship. I get that there are things like animal tarot cards and people talk about like, oh, what's that? You know, people ask me all the time because of my life experiences. Oh, I saw a hummingbird. What's it mean? I'm like, well, I don't know. It could mean like a lot of things. Here's what the totemic approach to it is. But I guess in some ways, like you do, I would say, what is your own relationship? What were you feeling at the time? What were you thinking at the time? Put these things in context. That's how you make sense of them.
And put them into relationship, right? So it might not be what the deer means, but what does the deer do? How do you relate? What are you doing together? How are you co-creating? And you know what, David, it is so magical and unsurprising that literally in my journal this morning, I wrote, we speak our world into being. And I was writing a post about how what we say becomes reality. And I just feel like so many pings of excitement about this. Like the deer, is the deer a traveler between the worlds, or is a deer part of the flower world? Because it seems like these worlds kind of bleed into or beings can move through them. But well, I guess my question is, or my thought is about how in the Western mind, everything is very distinct and discrete. So it's like you can take a deer out of its environment and it is still a deer. But I often think that you can't. Like, it's not the same being. If you take a being out of its environment, it is the environment. The environment, like nature, quote unquote, is all of it together. So perhaps the deer is also the flower world.
Yes. Well, you don't really know what you're talking about, but you've nailed it, if that makes sense, because there's no way you can understand how correct you are because you haven't spent a couple decades with the community. The flower world is inseparable from the deer. And I've tried to simplify it for the purposes of like a 20-minute talk that you may have heard me give or like a podcast like this. But in fact, to get to the flower world, you have to go to the wilderness world, which is the Huayanía. And when the deer shows up, that means that you're no longer just in the wilderness world. It means you're in the Sayanía. But that doesn't mean the deer is going to have anything to do with you. If the deer actually shows up and encounters you, now you're in the Yoanía, which is in the enchanted world. Now, let's say this all happens in a dream. That means you're also in the Tenkuanía, in the Tukanía, because you're in the night world and you're in the dream world. And all of these things would make sense if you were actually inside a cultural context. So I've had these moments where I've been inside the community, I've been living in the campo, and I would tell someone about something that happened to me out in the wilderness or in a dream. And, you know, people shut up and they listen to you. And then there's lots of pregnant pauses. And then people talk about what it means in the next day, because these things aren't accidental. There's these very rich, fertile, magical worlds we can live in if we just pay attention to them. And that's really what one of my points was about the flower world. The talk that you saw me give at the UCLA Botanical Center was that we associate, unfortunately, with the Yaqui, but also Native communities in general, that they have a psychotropic or hallucinogenic plant process. And this is the Castaneda effect. The Castaneda effect is, listen, there's all these different ways of knowing, and they're really incredible. And if we all just did drugs or datura or peyote, we would be able to see that this world is incredibly multidimensional. And my point is, or you could just slow down and not try to be productive and capitalist with your entire life and start taking all your relationships seriously and start using your words to create the world you want to live in rather than to reify some sort of abstract world. And when you start doing that, you realize the world has always been there, magical, right in front of you without the drugs. The drugs are also very interesting and they're fun and they can sometimes open the portal, but they're not the way, you know, capital T, capital W, for you to recognize that we're inside a cultural bubble. And when we start recognizing that there's a lot of difference there and a lot of, you might want to say, rich relation possible for us, it becomes such a more interesting world to live in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I want to segue here into that singing tree myth, which informed the Yoeme of the changes that were coming for them and their people. I'm really interested in this specifically because, you know, the tree appears in the cosmologies of, you know, people all across the world. And so I'm wondering, like, is the tree, and I'm bringing up trees because of their relationship with wands and with staffs and with everything, because I am trying to, you know, bring it all. This is our tarot podcast. So is the tree a divinatory tool? Like, tell me about the Yaqui tree myth and how it works.
It's so hard to have a conversation about content with me because I'm so caught up on words. I wouldn't call it divinatory because it would mean that there's something called divine, which means that there's something that's not divine. And I would say in a Yoeme world that we're talking about, which is pre-contact, we're not even just talking pre-contact. We may be talking pre-human. And I'll explain what that means. Is that the human, as we know of our shape and our movement through the world and our communicative technology of speaking, was not in effect. This is the world of the Surem, S-U-R-E-M. And these are called, in the anthropological terms, proto-humans. So they're going to become human someday. And they communicate telepathically with all living beings, plants, animals. They speak telepathically to each other. They know everything. It's called a unitary world. And in a world like this, it's really strange when you don't understand something, right? Because you're telepathic and you know everything. And all of a sudden, this tree starts making a humming noise. And it is bothersome. They have no idea how to make sense of this tree. That doesn't make sense. They don't understand.
Wait,
they
who?
Get that it's trying to, the Surum, these little 3 feet high proto-humans, which they don't understand how to make sense of this tree. And they can understand everything. And they're going around and like, do you understand what I'm saying? No, but we understand what I'm saying. And someone says, well, listen, there's this woman. She's really smart. And she communicates with fishes because of her powers. She has power from the Vawa'ania, the water world. And if you go talk to her, maybe she'll translate with the tree. So they travel and they go to her because she's living secluded like a lot of powerful women. And she's just living out there. And they show up. They're like, hey, we got this tree. We don't know how to make sense of it. And she's like, well, I'll figure out. So she goes to the ocean and she tells the ocean where she gets her power, I need the power to make sense of this tree. And she walks back and she goes to the tree and the tree is doing its humming. Her name, by the way, is Yomumuli, which is the Yome word for a hummingbird, making noise like a hummingbird. So she's listening to the tree and she's like, okay. So she essentially tells them, all right, so here's what the tree says. There's going to be these people coming, and they're going to be coming from another land. And they are going to offer us some new ways of doing things. Like, they're going to tell us to plant our food rather than hunt it. And they're going to seem pretty nice, but in fact, they're actually going to try to steal our land. So we have to be really careful. And I have to tell you all that the worst thing about this, according to the tree, is they're going to make us fight amongst ourselves about how to respond to them. And the tree told her a bunch of other things, like these metal snakes that travel across the land carrying people, and these huge birds that fly while carrying people on their back, all of which Yoime people in time have come to understand as trains and planes. Anyway, the Surum, these 3 feet high people, were in complete disagreement about how to respond to this information. They thought, well, we like new technologies. Oh, key insight. Oh, I forgot this really key thing. She tells them that you're going to get all these new technologies. And they're like, hey, yeah, we like the idea of not having to hunt for all of our food and to forage. And she goes, but if you stay around to meet them, it means that you're going to accept mortality because no one died when you're a Surum. So you lived forever. So you're going to have to accept aging as part of the deal. Half of the Surum decided they wanted nothing to do with that. And they went into the ground and are still there, which makes one of the Ania, Yoania, the Enchanted World, a place where you can meet them. And the other half decided to stay and become human. And those are the people who met the Spanish and the colonizers and the missionaries when they showed up. And so this tree is, in fact, like an Iliadian, Mercedes Iliadi, mythic tree. It is a tree that stood at the center of a community and communicated new morals and values for people to adhere to. But in the UMA context, what's really fascinating, and I've been to the hill where the tree was at. It's a Omtemekawe, which means angry mountain. I've been to Omtemekawe. And on top of Omtemekawe are radio towers that make humming noises when you stand under them from the high energy of electricity moving through them. And I've said to them, I said, doesn't it really disturb you that someone would come and put cell towers and electrical towers right on the place where the tree was at? And they said, no, it makes perfect sense. When prophecy tells you something and then you have proof of your prophecy, that's not a shameful thing. That's proof of your prophecy that we got new technologies and they're disruptive.
So that's not divination though?
I think it's divine in the sense that the question is, and this is a really key question for the artist Mario Martinez, who did the cover to my book. The cover of my book is literally, the Mario Martinez book is called The Conversation, which is his representation of the tree communicating. And it's so fascinating because when I said to him, I was like, oh, I love it, you know, because I'm an alleged know-it-all. I love it. It's like the tree telling the humans what's happening. And he's like, no, you didn't get it at all. That's the tree talking to who's talking to the tree. That's the question. Like, where did the tree get the information? So it is divine in that sense. I just don't like to use the word divine because it creates a hierarchy that there's this one all-powerful being from which all grace flows downward and we're going to be lucky to get it. I actually think it's more horizontal. And so I'm a little touchy around the word divine, but it wouldn't have any bearing on you, because I think in some ways people read the divine in the same way that they read sacred. It's part of a binary. Things are either sacred or they're not. And I would imagine that in one of the ways that I'm trying to disrupt hierarchical interpretations of pre-contact worlds in the indigenous context is I try to break through the hierarchy because it was probably more horizontal, which means you probably don't have binaries, you probably have spectrums. So things were more respected than others, not necessarily sacred or profane.
Also, that to me, that pings back to the beginning of our conversation when we were talking about the idea of the flower worlds and sacrifice and how the word sacrifice means to make sacred. And so.
Yeah, I think sacrifice is a key way of reading flower world. And one of the reasons, again, it's one of those things that you think if there's no way it can be coincidence, right? Like, why was my undergraduate advisor, the guy who wrote the article on flower worlds being embodiments of sacrifice and grace? And so to this day, if you want to in Yweme say, do you want to go to this ritual Sunday? In Yweme, it's translated as, do you want to go share the flower? And inside Yweme,
To ask if you want to go to the ritual is to go share the
right,
flower.
because ritual is the social performance of knowledge. It's the way that you sacrifice for your community. So lutuuria, which is the word for truth, translates as the social performance of knowledge. So truth is social, and you have to work for it. You have to work for truth, and it has to be done in a social way. That's what truth is. Well, when you think about all the ways it permeates Yweme culture, there's no way I could sort of throw these out offhand in a podcast and have them make sense. But it's every like men take off their hats. Generally, elder men wear hats, but even kids wear baseball caps, and they're taught not to put them open side down. You always leave your hat open up, and they tell you it's to catch the flowers. Flowers are conceptually thought to be moving around us all the time as signs of grace. And you want to be ready whenever you get to get graced by a flower, by someone else's sacrifice or your own. It's almost as if, well, there's another saying in Yweme, which is life is hard work. Work here being the sense of like you're always laboring or sacrifice. Well, all of that labor and sacrifice tallies up to something in the Yweme context called flower. So those flowers are in the wind. Those flowers are all around us, and you want to be ready when it's time for your flowers to be counted and given back to you.
Wow. I'm like just completely floored and also I'm kind of devastated that, my education, in philosophy when I first started studying, as an undergrad, didn't include all of this, that it was all just so westernized because this is, it's just such a it's blowing my mind in the way that they're conceptualizing the world. But I want that point about how truth isn't just objective. It's not just a state that exists outside of oneself that we can kind of arrive at like a fact, but that it's something that we create through ritual, through the flowers, through bringing it out as, language or dance or movement or action. That is just, I mean, wow, that could use a lot of unpacking. But, I was thinking about how one of the limitations of the tarot is that it's largely cerebral in nature because it was invented in, like 15th century Italy and developed in, the Western mystery traditions through the next 500 years, which where we become more and more rationalistic or, empirically oriented or, positivist. But so we might look at or discuss or contemplate or journal about the cards. But for me, sacred practices need to include the body and song and ceremony in order to be holistic, or they're not really, they're just living on the surface.
Right.
So could you talk a little bit more about how their practices for the Yomi of song and ceremony and dance? Can you tell me how they function in their culture a little more?
Sure. I mean, I'll do two things, because one is just the most simple sense of like that you could imagine being a positivist and listening to David Schroeder give a talk and think, yeah, but really, what do you mean when you say their words make, reality true? What I mean is that when you have singers, dear songs that start off the deer performance by saying in Yueme, there's this line that sort of starts off the deer songs, which is Empo Yohawea Aniwa, which is that you are the enchanted flower world. It starts off with you. It, literally, the line is, you are the enchanted flower world.
So the deer is saying
yes,
this.
Yes, because they're always sung from the perspective of deer. The deer is looking around at all these humans. The deer dancer who's performing deer is looking around at all these humans and he's saying, you are the flower enchanted wilderness world. You are the enchanted wilderness world. I see through the enchanted wilderness world. Who's the you? It's almost as if he's reminding us that we are part of the world. We're not separate from it. That was the Cartesian split that is so horrible about colonialism and education, is that we were told we're separate from our world. And it's that separateness that makes knowledge possible. That objectivity, which is neither a goal or possible at all. We've been living this, which is causing the ecological decline, is that we're somehow separate from it and we're not involved with it. And that's the best way to understand things, is to somehow not be related to it. And this is the lie.
Everything becomes an object.
Everything becomes an object. All medicine becomes an object. All the problems with you become an object. All your fixes, there's just objects that you can, hopefully afford to buy. These are all ways of separating yourself from the relation, the practice, the real life that's there. And it has a bearing on what we think of as even possible in terms of, like, I'm writing an article right now about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and how SETI has a defined intelligence and communication in odds with everything you and I have just been talking about for the last 45 minutes, which is that they think that communication is technological based and better be in English if it's at all intelligent. Or if there's any intelligence in the world, they have to have learned how to translate English, because, come on, it's the most intelligent language. And they have to have tried to reach out to us, because why wouldn't they? We're the pinnacle of technology. We're the most civil or civilized society. Now, look at communication from a performative aspect in how just in everyday life. I would say that there's this, I'm not going to say that this is UMA, though a UMA elder did tell me what to do here. So I had a dream once in which a deer was really, really a powerful presence in the dream. And I won't go into the presence to the actual, but when I got out of it, I called him and I said, this was more than a dream. I know the difference between non-real dreams and real dreams. And this is a real one, capital R D. This is a real dream. Something was being communicated to me there, but I don't know what it was. Like, I don't know how to make sense of it. And he's like, well, you have to show the deer world that you are hearing them, even if you don't know the content. So you need to go somewhere where deers are going to be, and you need to take some gifts for them, and you need to leave them for them. So he's essentially saying, don't let it just float off into another weird thing that happened to your life. Put it into practice. So there's me at probably, I think it was 37, doing research on what do deers like to eat? Where are deers around me? Now I have to get in my car on a Sunday and drive to somewhere where deers are. You have to actually do the work. You have to show up and you have to do the work. And that's the thing about, like, readings or dream interpretation or life coaching, is that people show up and they're like, hey, fix me. And you're sort of like, no, I'll show you how to do some work. And then you actually have to do it. It's like, sometimes have you ever given a reading to someone and you're like, you're not going to do a single thing I'm telling you right now.
Yeah. I always say that to my clients, that it's like, if you don't do the thing, then you won't get the benefit. And we often think about tarot, or we think about magic, or we think about crystals, or we think about wands, or we think about herbs, but we don't actually do the thing. And it's in the doing of the thing that you create it and make it real. So if you don't do it, then it doesn't become real. You can't speak it into being.
Exactly. Now, I know that witchery gets a bad notion about it in our culture, because we aren't in some ways awoke. We're not awakened yet to the ways that witchery is in some ways just putting into place a lot of things you and I have been talking about, creating the world you want to live in, using that sort of magical notion, not as something that's mystical and above us, but in our daily lives, right?
So do you think that these concepts that we're talking about, of course, like they're all culturally specific to the indigenous communities in which they're emerging from, but do you think that there's like a similarity between the indigenous communities in North America and Central America?
Yeah.
Or do they have radically different cosmologies or?
Yes. They have different radical cosmologies because they have different languages. Because, you know, I'm a linguistic constructivist. So your culture is based on your language and your perception is based on your language. And the way that you can communicate the reality that you live in is how that reality is sort of moving in your life. So because of that, you have all these different languages. So you have all these different cultures. Now, I was, as an undergraduate, when I was doing Native studies, incredibly fascinated with things like healers, singers, you know, the difference between them in Siberia and them in Africa. And so I was just reading everything I could. And I was trying to come up in a sort of anthropological sense. What is the grand takeaway? What is the one thing you can say about all these different cultures? Well, all these different cultures have people who have committed themselves to building these relationships, better understanding, if not mapping, the different dimensions, and, you know, putting those into place to help their community members. And I think what we used to think of in the Catholic Mexican sense as being bad, brujo, bruja, witch, is being reclaimed. This is the queer word now, is that it's time to reclaim witchery and make sure that you understand. Witches also help you feel better after a heartbreak. They help you make sense of the chaos of the world of death and loss. They help you create the reality that you want that could be a more loving, beautiful, flowering reality. It's not all just about like, oh, curses. And in some ways, those are based in the same mindset. But the things I saw when I worked with Amoya Kame were, he was healing people like cancer, flying people around the world would fly to him, you know, and he's living without any shoes on his feet, you know, like in a mud thatched house, no, not enough money to really, you know, buy meat, protein. And yet people from around the world are coming to him and he's curing them. He's healing them. And in that work, he's doing a lot of the same things I would think of when we think of the category of witches. He's doing prayers. He's doing incantations. He's blowing smoke on them. He's turning, you know, the material world into the air world through the process of putting things on fire. He has an altar. You know, I used to have an altar off and on in my life, and then I apprenticed with him, and now I would not imagine being able to live without an altar. Like, an altar is my house. Like, that's the definition of where my home is. Yeah, like, yeah, it's like saying I don't want a phone line. Yeah, I want a phone line to the other dimensions. Like, that's my altar. I don't always use it, but sometimes I need to make a call.
Okay, so weird little thing, in case you've noticed that my voice sounds a little different, lovely listeners out there. There was a little technical snafu, and our TAS cam, our very high-tech TAS cam, did a little meltdown. So now I'm recording straight onto my computer, in case you're like, what's going on? But anyway, we're coming to the end of the road here, and you know, it occurs to me that a lot of listeners will be really interested in and want to learn more about Yoami culture and traditions. But given the nature of white supremacist, capitalist colonialism, the ancestral traditions of, you know, and the earth-based practices of most, if not all, of our listeners will have been destroyed. And then perhaps, if, like, for instance, in my case, then my ancestors went and destroyed the cultures of other people. So basically what I'm getting at is, you know, the Yoami traditions will be very alluring, especially for those of us who don't have traditions of our own lineage to fall back on. So how can people not of Yoami heritage learn about this work respectfully?
I think that's one of the more continuous questions I get. The age group that's currently in my college classrooms at UCLA, I mean, they're very tuned into things like cultural appropriation, and they don't want to continue legacies of colonialism. And we have a dynamic in place in which outsiders go somewhere and then they extract from that area and then they distribute and make money off of that. And there's no way that I can separate myself from that dynamic because I'm not from that community. And in some ways I'm talking about matters of their life that they have not just protected, but they've actually paid prices for. I mean, Native people in the United States weren't even allowed to dance. They weren't allowed to speak their languages. And they've done this by persisting and making safe spaces inside their own communities for the knowledge bearers to continue the archive and the repertoire that is community-based knowledge. I would say that when students want to learn, rather than seeing it as an opportunity to just simply take or borrow, you might want to say, as they do in the fashion world or in the music world, instead of borrowing, but without asking particularly, you have to ask yourself, in what ways are you going to make sure that the people who've paid the most expensive price are somehow benefited? I, for example, want to learn about plant medicine right now. So I have sought out the indigenous person who teaches a class that's online because she's up in the state of Washington and you want these people to stay in their local communities where they can be. Luckily, I found one that has an online course that I can take with her so that I can make sure that the credit goes to her. In the case of Yoweme worldview or better understanding what other cultures are doing, I don't think we're supposed to live in these bordered communities where you don't share knowledge with others. I think you actually are supposed to learn about what other people do in different communities and different language systems. How can you do that? Well, look to see who the people are who are doing the communication. Felipe Molina, who is the collaborator I've worked with the longest, he is a co-author of a book called Maso Bwikum, Yaqui Deer Songs. So that's a really great way to get that information. I've co-written three pieces with him. Those are all on my website, davidshorter.com. I have a book, We Will Dance Our Truth, that's based on 23 years of being working with him. So not just a summer or two. And I mention the names. I tell you the people who I'm working with. I tell you the collaborators' names. So I think in some ways, if you can't get someone who's indigenous, get someone who's at least committed to continuing those relationships in a productive way that benefit indigenous people, or at least give credit to where the information is coming from. I guess last thing I would say is that you have to be able to go to bed at night with integrity. You have to be able to sleep at night knowing that you're a person who's making a better world in terms of that thing that we were talking about earlier, the actual lived life, the practice of living your life. If you want to get information and you can't get information about something that interests you, like Native worldviews, so then do it in another way. Make sure that you're keeping your eyes out for who are the Native people in the land that you live. In what ways are you making sure that their communities are getting healthy food, medicines, making sure that you're fighting for their sovereignty, and sovereignty including their rights of representation? So if you have Native people, for example, in Santa Monica, which we do, and we have Tongva people over there, and some Chumash people, and you have businesses like you do at Abbot Kinney, which have things like dream catchers and fake, you know, Native designed or inspired fabrics or fashions, call those businesses out and let them know these are offensive to people who are here in our community. They might not be offensive to me, but they're offensive to the Native people around us. So in some ways, it's about taking up the fight to decolonize the world we live in, even if it's not about the particular issue that we're talking about here today, which is just worldviews and cosmologies.
Right. So basically what you're saying is that it's not that you're not allowed to learn about other cultures. It's that you have to consider how you are giving to that culture, that it's not about taking from that culture, but that you are entering into relationship with the culture, and that that is not just about extracting and then exploiting and using that for your own benefit.
And you can actually follow no matter what heritage or ancestry you are and see that capitalism has run amok all over your ways of preserving and continuing power ways. So how can you go rescue them? Well, start doing that work. But don't forget, you're probably a settler on some indigenous lands, and to make sure that you're helping them as well.
Right. Beautiful. Thank you so much, David. Thank you so much for giving us this amazing knowledge and conversation. It has been just so delightful and so enriching. And gratitude to you, gratitude to all of the Yaqui people who informed this knowledge and work, and their ancestors and all their relations as well. How can we find out more about you? Like, if people want to know and go dive deeper, like, how should they stay in touch or find out?
Well, I maintain a website, which is www.davidshorter.com. And that is where I post essays, interviews, podcasts. I even communicate to some of my students via their about like upcoming classes. I'm a professor at UCLA. One could apply to be a PhD student in the Department of World Arts and Cultures. And then additionally, I have a private practice in Van Nuys called In the Light Reiki. I'm a Reiki master that was attuned by the last living lineage of the person who created Reiki in Japan 2 years ago. I went to go study with him. So in that private practice, I'm in the process of even developing my own workshops, which were going to start this year before the virus came. And now they'll start next year, which just gives me more time to ruminate and overthink things and, yeah, that sort of stuff.
Well, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Ah, thank you. Thanks to Carolyn, the production team, and all the best to you, Amanda. I'm just so happy to see how everything's going for you right now. Mwah. Bye.
Listeners, thanks so much for tuning in today. It was such a pleasure to have you here. Please stay tuned for next week when we'll be having everybody's favorite fashion witch, Gabriella Hurstick, on to discuss the joyous and celebratory Four of Wands. And if you have a second, please do pop over to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. It really helps us spread the magic. See you next week.
Between the Worlds is hosted by Amanda Yates Garcia and produced by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs with editing help from Jiha Lee. Our podcast icon is created by Maria Minnis, aka Tiny Parsnip, links in the show notes, and our font is created by Leah Hayes. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please consider leaving us a sweet review and or posting your favorite parts. You can tag us at Oracle of LA or Between the Worlds Podcast. Thank you.
Turn your will towards your desire, fire guides you on, enlightens the path and shines the way, call upon the suit of wands.